Yes, the whole text. It's one text which is 100 something, 50 pages, three parts. This is the second part. I was asked to write it, so I wrote it, and then on the ground I decided to make a course. So the first one was the Indic approach to language. Now we have Western approaches to language. And then the third part was a comparative part of both. And now I will skip the third one, because it will be naturally that we are building it on the ground of Indian view, and we will see why they come to the Western view already equipped with another paradigm. Yes, so we will be always comparing. But yes, we had a gap. We didn't have a gap. We had. We had. And it was the most difficult thing, it seems, especially for those who were not equipped with a Vedic paradigm. But I had to go into it once to see also for myself how far it is possible to speak about it. So I took metaphysical Vedic paradigm of the planes of the being, tried to look into it from the linguistic point of view. And I think it matches one to one. So if you have some questions for the previous part, I think they will be solved in this part.
Okay.
But if they are completely unavoidable for us, then please ask them now. We can discuss them before we move into another paradigm altogether. About Indic vision. Do you have something very burning to ask? Something which is absolutely misunderstood or far away from... No, I think it's altogether so far away that but it's fine to keep it far. I'm joking.
All the notes that you showed there last week will be on the website.
Right. They are already
okay.
On the website. I was encouraging you to enter our website and maybe even to start some discussions, which would be very nice, to post your writings, arguments, and would be lovely if we could make it alive. And of course, if you could make some papers, as Rod suggested, that would be even better. So we are at the part two. So there are no questions. We move ahead. Yes. Well, so now we are moving into another tradition, which was somehow built later and was confused in some way. And on that confusion we got another perception of the word. So it's quite interesting how Sri Aurobindo describes Greek civilization in Human Cycle and other places. He says that it was inspired by Eastern Indian tradition. And if we look in carefully, closely into the pantheon of gods, we will find that it is a kind of a caricature of Indian pantheon. Same set of gods with same kind of behavior, but very humanized, with jealousies, with envies, all kinds of human doshas, faults. But, of course, in India it was also in Puranic literature we find the same story where gods are becoming very human-like. Fight among themselves. Vishnu and Shiva fight for 1,000 years and cannot win. So they get tired and say, it's enough for fight. Let us coexist. So they coexist. But it was only in Puranic literature. Before, in Vedic literature, it was different. So if we see that Greek gods are coming from somewhere or inspired from the East, because there was no other tradition of similar kind in the Middle East at that time. Semitic tradition is completely different. It's based on different principles. So there must be only one influence, that is Indic influence. And if you look closer to Apollonian and Dionysian mysteries, especially Apollonian, also Dionysian, then you will find that it comes from Troy, from already East, from that influence of the sun god and sun cult, which was purely Vedic and Aryan cult. Yes? So the whole Aryan tradition is being, how to say, taken by Greeks from where they started. There were deeper roots. They were always mentioning in their tradition of those bards who were singing from Homerian time, you know, singing about those previous times of Atlantida and Lemuria. All those names are known to us from Greeks. And then there was a shift from Pythagoras, Heraclitus and Socrates. We have a shift of paradigm from one mythic to rational structure. But what is interesting, it is in this period of Socrates that we have language being built up and the alphabet invented. It's approximately 700-600 BC that the alphabet was invented. And as we know, it was taken from Hebrew tradition, and it was Hebrew alphabet was adopted and made its own in Greek civilization. I do not know how it happened, nobody knows, there are no details about this, but we can see that Aleph, Bet and so on, alphabet is from the same tradition which Moses brought to his people. Moses himself created this alphabet on the ground which was very mysterious. He was reflecting of the mystery of knowledge he was initiated into from Egyptian times, from Egyptian knowledge, and not only from Egyptian cults but also from black race cults from Ethiopia. He had two initiations. He was twice initiated, yes, in Egypt and Ethiopia. And his knowledge was profound, of course. So what he brought to his people was the alphabet which he saw while meditating on the hill of Sinai. And when he was there meditating for many days, months, his people were waiting for him to come down with some kind of revelation. So he brought them alphabet. And that alphabet was the whole mystery of creation, 22 arcanus as we know them. Arcanum means the secret. So there were 22 secrets which were codifying the whole knowledge. So five books which he wrote were codified in this particular system of knowledge. If we know Kabbalah and read those books, we will find another layer of information in that Old Testimony. So, but what he ignored completely is the language, the articulation of sounds, the natural way of articulating certain meaningful sounds. He loaded his knowledge of language with another system of meaning. It became completely symbolic. Aleph, it's the first letter A, because it is reflecting the triple world, and it is written in triple way. Those of you who know Hebrew, there are three lines. A And there are symbolic pictures behind them. Yes, this is what we call arcana. The whole mysterium is built on those pictures, on those symbols, and on those colors and numbers. So the whole alphabet is a heavily loaded system of knowledge. And all those names of gods, also, they reveal something of their character in this mysterium creation. I studied Kabbalah for a few years myself, and I must say that this is the most profound knowledge you can find besides Vedic. So we can really look into both of them, maybe later in the University of Human Unity, which I was proposing to study, these two systems of knowledge, and see what was common in them both. Actually, when I was joining University of St. Petersburg, my first and only aim was to find the common ground of both traditions. That's what I said in my introductory interview, that I would like to find a common ground of Semitic and Vedic tradition. They looked at me, what? Nonsense. Okay, you know nothing, so let us study. So, and it was true, because then I couldn't really do that. I couldn't study Hebrew together with Sanskrit. Sanskrit was already too much, and all those other languages. So I had to drop Hebrew. I wanted also to study Tibetan, and I studied Tibetan to a certain moment, and I couldn't. Two different languages, too many things. So, but, yes.
Didn't Mother make a remark about Theon, that he had also his knowledge from his two different sources? I think there is something like that.
Right.
She mentions that Theon had not only from Vedic, but from Kabbalah, something from right. Two sources.
Right. And moreover, she brought from Theon the symbol to Sri Aurobindo. And this symbol represents two traditions, Semitic or Chaldean tradition, that is the David star, and the Vedic tradition, the lotus inside, the seven waves. She put them together because, according to Theon, there was one pre-Chaldean, pre-Vedic tradition, which was common for both. Of course, for theosophical knowledge, for Blavatsky's views, it was different. Semitic was pre-Vedic, pre-Aryan tradition. It was more ancient, because Aryan race appeared later in time, it seems. There was another civilization on earth before Aryan race could come in. And this, in esoteric history, it is known that Rama was first, by the way, who brought the esoteric cults of Aryan race. But this is all knowledge which we do not have evidence of. Yes, we can speak about it as myths and traditions which are very dubious in their sources, especially theosophical. It was all foreseen from the subtle plane, and she was receiving information directly and writing it. Though Sri Aurobindo was highly speaking about her intuitions, Blavatsky's intuitions. He said that she had visions, she had certain intuition, but she mixed up many things. Why am I speaking so long about this? Because here will be the whole answer about these two traditions and what happened to linguistics. So, what was interesting in observation of Sri Aurobindo is that if Greeks were conceived by Eastern, by Indic tradition somewhere, then they carried it and embodied it in the aesthetic and ethic way. They built up their own civilization on that ground. But the core, the inner core, the inner meaning was Indic. It was always there somewhere, hidden within that completely different view or build-up of the civilization. Then, when it was conquered by Romans, it was taken, which was more aggressive civilization, more materialistic, but that element was again, how to say, not worshipped, adored, was again valued, and it was again secretly hidden within the whole Roman, civilization. Then when Christians came and brought their tradition, it was again cognized as if it joined, because Christian tradition itself is not very much Semitic, if we look into that, what Jesus brought with his, you know, preachings. It was very close to the Vedic tradition. And it's not for nothing that they speak about him as if he was traveling to India and was initiated in Kashmir. And even now in Kashmir somewhere they have his tomb where he is buried. It seems that he came back after being crucified.
That's
right. And they have the, yes, there is the whole book written about this. They traveled his way and people speak legends in that region about him coming from the west and so on and so forth. But I am not going into that very seriously. I'm just pointing out that his teaching was so radically different from the Old Testimony that Jews could not recognize him. They really could not take him as his own. First of all, he said, me and my father are one. And that was blasphemy. You couldn't really preach such things according to the Old Testament. And so on and so forth. Many things he did which were very Indic and even Vedic. And when we studied the Hymns to the Mystic Fire, we found all passages about Father and the Son. And how the Son is redeeming his Father. It is Agni, that son who is growing, who will liberate the father in this creation. So all these views were, and language is very close to the Christian language, in the Vedic Hymns to the Mystic Fire, Book 5. So when Christian religion was spread by Roman Empire, what happened there was a new blend of two Greek hidden tradition which they, swallowed but didn't absorb. They were holding it as something secret and very valuable. And then when Christianity came in, it somehow was strengthened, was more stabilized in some way. And then Roman Empire grew, it took over the whole Europe, established in Goslar, Kaiser, it was Roman emperor who established Kaiser of Goslar in Germany. And Germany also took again this Roman civilization with all that outward setup, their own things, and that inner core hidden within the civilization. Now, what happened later was quite interesting when Sanskrit a culture was discovered in 18th century in Europe. It was Germans who first jumped on it with full awareness and necessity to find their origins. In that moment of time they were seeking for their self-identity, and because of that they needed some input, and they found that in Aryan tradition. So what they did, unfortunately, with their zeal, they identified with that Aryan tradition so much that they wanted to be the only ones who were Aryans. And all others, like Frenchies and Italians, and Spanish, not to speak about Slavic tribes, which are even farther, were of inferior origin and were belonging to Greeks, Latin Greek origin. So Latin Greek origin was, in their kind of preaching, separated from pure Aryan origin. But it was later. First it was a very interesting move, and we can see later, starting from Humboldt and Hegel and others, were speaking about these things differently. They were seeking for real things, yes? Especially Humboldt. Who is considered to be the father of all Western linguistics. Now, What is interesting here, when Germany recognized the element of Indic element, which was hidden so long, how long it was hidden, it was in Greek civilization hidden, covered up with completely different set, then it was traveling to Roman Empire, building the whole Roman civilization, then it was again adopted by Germans, and finally it was discovered, that mysterious mystic element within that culture, and it was Aryan element. Now that was a big boost in Europe. 19th century, it was all about India. All humanities, all the subjects of humanities. Now we are not talking about that, but if you go to those books, you will find that it is all about that particular thing.
Poetry,
literature, mythology, history, all Indo-Europeistica, all new subjects, all comparative disciplines of comparative religion, comparative mythology, history, literature, language, linguistics.
And trickled down into culture as one of the prints of the new silks in the 19th century was all Orientalism.
Yes.
All Indian and Chinese,
yeah.
The arts, the dances, all this stuff.
Yeah, it was a renaissance of India in Europe.
And it was not only the language, also all the gems and all the treasures that you
found. Treasures, especially treasures.
Yeah.
Madame de Pompadour, she wanted to have diamonds, and she said, where to go? You go to India. And she showed, and they went to Pondicherry. This is because of Madame de Pompadour that Frenchies came to Pondicherry. Is it not interesting that she wanted to have diamonds? That's why Pondicherry was colonized by Frenchies first, where later Sri Aurobindo found his refuge from British.
Flying to Patmos, to that island of where John had his revelation. And even then he says in the poem, but we have come from further away, from Ganges and so on and so far. These poems really, they try to link up the whole tradition actually. Always the Greek was the perfect idea, and then even they try to come further.
Yes, and this interest was not only among Germans, but also Frenches. And everybody, yes, everywhere the universities were established studying Sanskrit. Sanskrit was a must for anybody who wanted to have a degree in philology. Now, you couldn't have a degree in philology if you didn't study Sanskrit grammar in Europe in 19th century. But because of this insistence of Germans to have exclusive rights on Aryan origin and kind of pointing that others are of different origin, there was this shift. And many French institutions and universities turned away from this slowly. That's why even Saussure, who was a Sanskrit teacher for 20 years, is not even mentioned later that he was a Sanskrit teacher. There's some political reason for that. There was a different time, which we do not see it now, and we think, why all others turned away from Indic studies? Because of this particular reason, that there was too much insistence of Germans who were claiming their rights over all Europe. And because of that, there was a political clash, and also academic.
I was just looking last week, I got this website. There's a German university which has all Indian literature, you know, in Sanskrit and Tamil, you know, on the website, and then there are readers writing to them. And one person was writing, why do you still call yourself Indo-Germanic? Because all the others call it Indo-European. And then he, his professor, is still so conservative. He tried to justify that it was like a bracket. They said from Sri Lanka up to the Germanic area, it covers this thing. Right? But this is really strange, this conservatism. Somehow still there. All Europe calls it, French calls it in the France and I have European and English was in the UK and the Germans report it in the Germanic. Up to today in Austria also. And I was wondering what is this? But they try to justify it in another way. But maybe I also thought that they just say this could have been why they removed themselves better. They called it in the UK.
If you remember, yes, how it was in Hitler's time, in all these dossiers, if they write about their own officers, high rank officers, the first definition is he is true Aryan. Full stop. True Aryan. Aryan race. Hitler was growing Aryans in the north of Poland. He found, he was breeding them, yes. Yes, he was growing these people. He found special, there has to be special forehead, special chin, special eyes, color, height, skeleton. It was a scientific research, and he wanted to grow them, to breed them as, you know, animals, and populate all over the world. All others have to be, yes, yes, even Germans. The Germans didn't know about that, that they were not meant to live for long. They were kind of an instrument to conquer the thing, and then there was another race. And he was justifying it. And look at this, it's interesting, because Hitler comes in the time when Sri Aurobindo was here speaking about the divine race. So what happened in that sense that the Asura, of the Lord of Nations, his mother called him, substituted the ideal with racial ideal of Aryan race and wanted to kill everybody in that name. Look at this interesting twist. Sri Aurobindo also spoke about physical immortality, and Hitler also spoke about this. He had the whole theory, but we are not going into that. It's the reason why Hitler was a great mystic, by the way, and all his Nazi, the top officers. We know about this, at least we in Russia know about this, because Russians were so much against any religion and any Nazi, so they collected all the material and published it. Now they would not do it. But that time they were not afraid to do that as a propaganda for materialism and communism and so on. So what happened, because of this trend, unfortunately, all Indic studies were diminished and belittled by purpose. Belittled to the extent that they were, the whole tradition in Europe turned towards Greeks again and tried to find in Greeks that what they discovered through Sanskrit. And it's not a bad trend. Of course, it's a little offensive for Indic studies, as many people feel, especially Rajiv Malhotra feels that there has to be justice brought back to India, and I agree with him. But sooner or later it will come. So, now, I just gave you a historical background for you just to feel that time, that it was a bit different than we now imagine. Now I come back to our linguistic studies and wanted to observe certain tendencies in two different traditions, Vedic and Semitic. I won't dwell on concepts too much. Of course, there is the same concept, creation by the word, in Semitic tradition and Vedic, yes, the God creates by word. He says, let it be this and it is that. Let it be light. And the light appears. The interesting, funny thing is that Nolini says that actually the God had to say, let it be darkness. And darkness had to appear because he was light. Why should he say, let it be light if he was light? In a way, that shows something on that nature of that God, as Mother spoke on this Yahweh, Jehovah, that most probably that God wasn't really that God. He was representing some other forces. So in a New Testimony we have again this vision which is purely Vedic. So it's well-known phrase that the beginning was the Word and Word was with God and Word was God. The passage sounds exactly Shabda Brahman of Bhartrihari or Paravak of Kashmirian Shaivism. And their separation especially. As Vimarsha moves away from Prakasha and generates, creates the world. Now, what has actually happened then? First of all, the difference between two traditions is striking because Vedic tradition was building their language on the articulation of the human being. The sounds were sorted out according to articulatory device. The Semitic tradition was building language on the system of other knowledge, of mysterium, 22 laws of mysterium, which were codifying, it was like a code, not language, codifying particular system of knowledge, and therefore ignored these articulatory possibilities or articulatory apparatus of man. The whole body of clearly demarcated sounds in the mind and articulated by the vocal apparatus, whereas the Hebrew, instead of working out the language on the basis of articulation, codified in the latter a hidden symbolism of their own mystic tradition, and therefore did not have any clearly scientifically developed alphabet as a system of articulation. So they had another system within the alphabet. Now this is the beginning of confusion, because when Greeks took it, they already took something else. That wasn't language. That wasn't really related to language, that was related to another system of knowledge. Moreover, Jews were hiding, they were having syllabic writing as Sanskrit. It's also showing that they are most probably from the same origin, but they were hiding their own vowels within the syllable. As we have in Sanskrit, A is not written, the same way vowels were not written, but were presumed. In order to read those texts, you had to be an adept of that tradition, knowing what vowel has to be there. So what they saw mainly consonants, and here and there a few vowels, which are starting words. So what is being said, and you will read many such articles, if you want to just Google them for Greek alphabet, and you will find that articles are saying that Greeks invented vowels. Absurd. You won't believe it. That vowels were not before. Greeks invented vowels. As if language can exist without vowels. So they invented letters for vowels because vowels were not demarcated clearly in the Hebrew writing. So what they did, they simply invented letters. They deviated from syllabic writing. They went away from syllabic way of thinking about language. They introduced letters. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Now what we have here, it's interesting, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you can hear yourself. B, C, D, E, F, G. Why suddenly all these vowels are there? E's. What? They are not there, no? In D there is no E, but you can't say D. So you need vowels. So this also shows that syllabic way of thinking is a natural for human language. So that's why we have A, B, C, D, E, F, G. It's natural. There is no A, B, C, D. A, B, C, D. Even then I have to add vocal cords, otherwise you would not hear. It will be only a touch, a friction. Friction needs to be carried by vocal cords. It has to be recognized through the sound. Now, that is first deviation which was crucial, which was the beginning of all misunderstanding of language. First of all, it's not clear why this order, Abed said there, doesn't say to you why this order, where it is being articulated and what it means. It doesn't say anything. It's not kakha gaghama. All articulatory sounds, cha 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 nya, on all the levels, clearly, gathered in system which is obvious for the mind, and mind can dwell on it and understand the whole process of articulation. It is something which still remains mysterious. And from that mystery of language, the whole mystery of linguistics starts in Europe. Nobody understands what it means and where it comes from and what it really says. Why we speak about these things in this way, nobody knows. Because the alphabet does not reflect any human capacity to articulate in a meaningful way sounds.
But in Greek, they have names for the letters. They didn't say Abed, they said Alpha, Beta, yeah. Gamma, Delta.
But they took it from Hebrew. This is Hebrew's names.
So they had names, they just gave names.
No, they took it from
the
Hebrew.
Vowels and, yeah. And the...
consonants, vowels, and
you mean these names were already accounted?
Yes, they are from Hebrew. They are these Hebrew names. Yes, Aleph, Beths, and so on.
So, in Hebrew, what order of alphabet did they go?
The same.
As the Greeks? The
Greeks took it from Hebrew. They took alphabet of Hebrew.
So they took the Greeks took the Hebrew alphabet and inserted
and added their own sounds, which they had in their own language, in between here and there, and that was it. Moreover, the whole Greek tradition was trying to follow Hebrew's tradition, mystic tradition.
So, in Hebrew, why was it the order that it's in? I mean, it's not like this random Greek order, right? Like, it was already a random order from the Hebrew alphabet?
Hebrew alphabet was ordered differently. It means different order. It's not the articulatory device order.
Right.
So what is the principle of order?
The principle of order is the whole mysterium, 22 laws of existence. It starts with one. One is the magician. He's triple in his nature.
And that's Aleph.
Aleph. Bet is B, is two pillars, and in between there is the Izida, the Isis, the mother, whose veil nobody ever opened. She holds the scroll and the lotus, and she sits on the cube between binar element of duality, second number, and so on and so forth.
So is there something corresponding to epsilon or eta? Probably not.
Few letters were invented like this, omega and others, which were not there. Yes, they added few letters.
Not all, apparently not all of the vowels, because there is omega.
All right.
Maybe there is omega on too.
Yes, Aleph is there. Ah, they didn't need to invent ah. Also, yod is there. E is there. All those vowels are there. But there are few other vowels which are not there according to the Greek pronunciation, because Greek is rich in vowels. So. Right.
It's one of the codes.
Right. This is Kabbalistic vision. All this numerology which comes later, all that what we are playing cards, yes? Mm-hmm. This gypsy cards, tarot, which is called, it is all coming from that knowledge which was profound. And if you look into that once, the depth of it is enormous, something really worth studying. But we don't have time for this, unfortunately, to look into that, how it was built, because it really takes many, many sessions to look into that. And if you want, maybe we will build a course on it, because I would love to go to that. What it does, it builds your mind differently. You think differently afterwards. Because these 1, 2, 3, 4 numbers corresponding to the letters, to the colors, to the symbolic pictures. Yes? Everywhere there is a symbol of certain action. And every arcanum has many secretums. So the whole system was built like this, secretum building one arcanum letter, which builds the language, mysterium. Now all those names of different gods, Mikael, Gabriel, they have specific meaning if you read them Kabbalistically. Every letter adds to that meaning. Yahweh, Yehovah also, it's number 8. It all has very specific place in the system of knowledge, but not as an articulatory device.
But is this the sense of multi-dimensions behind that you get in the Vedic, the amazing yantras, the sacred geometry, all that is embedded in the letters?
Yes, letters carry different significance, not paying much attention how we articulate and how we speak. So another tradition, Vedic, builds completely on different level, on the level of articulation, of the meaningful sounds. So when Western scholars discovered Sanskrit, they were astonished, because they never could imagine that articulation can be so transparent and clear, that there can be different alphabet. Can you imagine that? Different alphabet, not A, B, C, D, everybody knows, but kakha gaghanga, cha cha ja janya. You can imagine what an impact it had. So the whole 19th century started to review all the basics of everything. That was the beginning of even, I think, linguistics in general. And if Humboldt is considered to be the father of Western linguistics, then Humboldt himself spoke, conversed in Sanskrit with his students. He knew by heart Bhagavad Gita. For him, the beginning of the whole revision of the human mentality was in the Sanskrit language. He wrote the most fundamental introduction, which became the... We will come to Humboldt later, which became the foundation of all linguistics later. It's a very interesting change in the perception. That's why, most probably, when they discovered kakha gaghana and compared it with A, B, C, D, they understood that there is some higher principles, more luminous, more transparent, more mental, more rational, that we can really possess, and our mentality can be more luminous. That's what he was proposing. So difference in alphabet we just looked into. Now, I would like to come today and cover maybe 2 different views presented by Socrates and Aristotle, where the shift of paradigm was already taking place. So, Socrates, I will read his quotations. It's the best way, because he is very brief and very precise. There's nothing to talk around. But where satisfactory remedies have been found for dispelling these illusions by measuring, counting, and weighing, we are no longer at the mercy of an appearance, phenomenon, of difference in size and quantity and weight. The faculty that has done the counting and measuring or weighing takes control instead. And this can only be the work of the calculating or reasoning element in the soul. Now look at these definitions. They are so fresh. They are on the edge from one paradigm to another. The soul, the element, calculating element in the soul, we are not at the mercy of appearance anymore. We can know things precisely as they are. We can measure them, count them, weigh them, describe them, and this is the element in the soul which does it. There is a clear shift from the mysterious perception of that phenomenon of reality to the rational, which is no longer the mercy of phenomenon, but is grounded on facts of reality of scientific inquiry into all possible measurements. This faculty of reason is called by Socrates the reasoning element in the soul, which later in Aristotelian view will represent the soul. Now, there will be a shift from Socrates' element in the soul to the soul as the body, the intelligent body of man. There will be no more distinction between the two later in Aristotelian view. We will come to it. But how shall we further analyze them, and when does the imitator begin? Now he calls him an imitator. Imitator who uses the language. Imitation of the essence is made by the syllables and letters. He still remembers the syllables. Later syllables will be forgotten completely. Ought we not, therefore, first to separate the letters, just as those who are beginning rhythm first distinguish the powers of the elementary sounds, and then of compound sounds, and when they are done so, but not before, proceed to the consideration of the rhythms. Must we not begin in the same way with letters, first separating the vowels, and then the consonants and mutes into classes, according to the received distinction of the learned? Also the semi-vowels, which are neither vowel nor yet mutes, and distinguishing into classes the vowels themselves. And when we have perfected the classification of things, we shall give their names and see whether, as in the case of letter, there are any classes to which they may all be referred, and hence we shall see their natures, and see too whether they have in them classes as there in the letters.
Before you go further, it might be interesting to point out right here that this is the origin of Derrida's theory of deconstruction.
Right.
Exactly at this point.
Yes, I take it from him,
actually. Hegel, well, it starts with Heidegger's deconstruction of Hegel, which is almost verbatim this Socratic description. And according to Hegel, where the phenomenon is reflected by the name, at that point, the logos, the knowledge, becomes separate from that which is perceived. The thing itself, at this moment of naming, becomes the reality as opposed to the phenomenon. And from this moment, we begin to construct both language and meaning. And this construction is precisely what Derrida wants to deconstruct as a result of phenomenology, which was an attempt by Heidegger to get back to the thing itself. So the whole theory of deconstruction is based upon this juncture in the development of language,
yes.
This Socratic moment.
It's a very important thing, but maybe not many of you really read Derrida or something. What is interesting here, I was doing it exactly for that very reason, to see why Derrida says about Saussure that the distinction between signified and signifier is not naturally coming out of that logocentric culture, so it is brought in from somewhere else. And from that point of view, I wanted to see the influence of Sanskrit culture in the Indian Renaissance. I thought Saussure got it from India rather than from that culture which was there building up, believing in the word as a reality.
It's Hegel.
Hegel is mostly that, yes. For him, spirit, word, spirit and spirit are one and the same.
Spirit is word.
Yes.
Not word is spirit.
But what is interesting here, I have my own interesting view on it. I came to it through this study, and it's very complex, and also very interestingly, adding to that the reader's view. I want to share this with you. Maybe we will be able to break through. I'm not sure. But because there are different considerations. Only few of us have these considerations. Others do not care about these, you know, distinctions. They are less important. But if we make them important for a minute, just to see what it means, and maybe we will be able to break through. So if we read, interestingly, now finish his quotation, what he says about that. So first we now, in the way how he speaks, the way is very important. Must we not begin in the same way with letters, first separating the vowels, then the consonants, the mute semivowels, classify them, and when we have perfected the classification of things, we shall give their names and see whether, as in the case of letter, there are any classes to which they may all be referred, and hence we shall see their natures and see too whether they have in them classes as there are in the letters. Now what is this? Just look at this. What is he doing? What is he trying to say? Now, I will finish the quotation and we come back. And when we have well considered all this, we shall know how to apply them to what they resemble, whether one letter is used to denote one thing, or whether there is to be an admixture of several of them, just as in painting. The painter who wants to depict anything sometimes uses purple only, or any other color, and sometimes mixes up several colors. As his method is when he has to paint fresh colors or anything of that kind, he uses a particular color as his figures appear to require it. And so too we shall apply letters to the expression of objects, either single letters when required or several letters, and so we shall form syllables, as they are called, and from syllables make nouns and verbs, and thus, at last, from the combination of nouns and verbs, arrive at language. Large and fair and whole, just as the painter uses his paint to produce a living creature.
This concept of relating it to painting, here we're still talking about language as a representation of something, because the painting is a representation of something, which is not a thing.
And actually, not just representing a thing, but representing a class of things. According to this theory of knowledge, what we know is the class of things. So what's being outlined here is not just a system of language, but it's a system of conceptual or general knowledge.
But if I understand right, but at the same time what he wants to say is really what Rakers didn't do, or when he had this cousin party, how he had one of them, we have all these different options. So he's trying to show that language unfolds step by step, and he gives a meaning into the basic sound. And not in the ready-made word or only in the sentence.
What is surprising me most in this description that Socrates deals with language as if there was no language. Do you see this? He starts from the beginning. We will assign to them as if he has no tradition before.
Yeah. It's, because in the beginning you said to classify the Latin, but who's classifying, who putting this simply? I mean, so it depends what you have in mind, what you're classifying.
So, what I made a few notes here, it is a profound and detailed description of the whole process of scientific inquiry in linguistics to arrive at the elemental particles clearly defined and classified as different from each other, and then to proceed in synthesizing them into greater units, but already being conscious of their character in the synthesis. What is interesting here in this example of Socratic speech is that he presumes nothing as predetermined or given as knowledge before, as if he has no tradition behind him and proceeds by his own power of rational inquiry, affirming that it is possible for us, wherever we are, to discover and to arrive at truth.
Precisely where Heidegger is correct. He says this origin of scientific thinking is what brought about the schism in consciousness between the logos as self-presentation of being and the logos as word, as rational thought. And you're right, it's as if there nothing was known except what can be known systematically. And Hegel has taken all of this verbatim almost, the science of spirit or the science of mind. This is how the mind understands things.
But it's still interesting that he relates it to painting, because painting is an art. I mean, these days we would describe it as an art and not a science, but of course we know it's a combination, really. Because it's the same mind. But still, it's that place where, of total freedom, where we have elements and we create them in whichever way we want. We make something new. You know? Yeah. So he's opening up a field of freedom.
No, he says it's systematic. He says that it is systematic. We have to discover those colors, how they work, how they blend, and then we can create. But we will know what we create because we know the elements in their system. We know what it does to us, and it must be corresponding to reality. It can't be that reality is something else. And there will be one more argument, exactly this.
Is there maybe a similar picture also in the Bauhaus art? Because you have very original parts, structured parts, and then all of it, the creation, creative forms in the Bauhaus.
And even in Sanskrit alphabet, they are called varnas. Varna means color. These are varnamala. Alphabet is a mala, the garland of colors. Vibrations.
Sure. So,
yeah, yes. So, of course, so this is the essence of the very characteristic of the Western rationality. By your own consciousness, as I defined it, this interesting, by your own consciousness and power, you can know things as they are. You don't need any other authority to know. All your knowledge is within you. You can discover it. If you apply your mind, your heart, your being, your consciousness, you can know things. You can systematize them as you want to systematize them and know them. You don't need to have other authority. That's what Socrates brought into perception. I think from him all this freedom of inquiry starts. Because he was that free inquirer, roaming around and showing how it can be done. Of course this...
Again, in a way, it's liberating again in a way, because it, again it's saying you can trust your own body, because there is a systematic material element in there that will behave a certain way. We don't necessarily need to read this book. We can go into this practice and trust our own body and look up to the same answer that is already written in the book.
Exactly. And it happens all the time. All our life, what we do, we just recognize in the books what has already happened to us. And nothing else we recognize. We can't see something which didn't happen to us. That's why we say, this is a good book. Not that book. What is important to our purpose of linguistic studies here is that separation on the letters, as classification of them is mentioned here, which as I think became the issue in creating a letter-based alphabet and another altogether different perception of language as a synthetic work of the rational mind. We are moving to the mind. The mysterious perception of meaning based on the higher consciousness was reconstructed by Socrates into a rational construct by the individual. But now he has to address the mysterious issue of the first names and their construct by the higher consciousness, pointing out to the original meaningful system of sounds, comparing it with pains. Now, this is again what would be interesting for you. Very good, he says, but if the name is to be like the thing, the letters out of which the first names are composed, first names, must also be like things. Returning to the image of the picture, I would ask how anyone could ever compose a picture which would be like anything at all if there were not pigments in nature which resembled the things imitated and out of which the picture is composed. So this is the question of material. Is that material not the very sense of thing, the very meaning of it, the very stuff of it? Is not that vibration which comes, that paint which vibrates, not a part of nature which we want to describe? But here he refers to original names which were composed, and if they were to be like the things, then there should be also something in the nature of that kind by which one could make them. In other words, the things are the manifestation of some intelligence, knowledge, consciousness, being carried within its own substance. It is by this particular view, introducing the two approaches simultaneously of intelligence working with matter and the matter being intelligent, that he becomes known in the history as a representative of the transition from the mythical structure of consciousness to the rational. Intelligent substance by which we describe, it has its own structure, it can be systematized, it can be known. There is a deeper look into rationality. This look we never have. We never see that the materials by which we paint, by which we speak, are systematic representatives of the same nature, which we want to describe.
If I may, I think it's relevant, I have had in the past very strong experiences with nature, and one of them was to rediscover pigments through nature, like mixed colors out of rocks. There was about five or six colors, a deep red, pink, very iridescent green, different rocks. It was in Greece, in Crete. And the paintings that came out of those, because there was nothing, we had nothing, so we the things that we found. We made paper out of newspaper from the local cafe. And the shapes, my heart beats because it's a very old experience and I think a very relevant one to what the consciousness is in its substance. I am not a painter. I've never learned painting and nothing more system of painting, but the shapes that came out of the 8 panels that came out of those particular substances and colors that we found in the nature were very similar to then later we went to Knossos, and they were very similar shapes that came out.
So they did
out of the land, something in the substance were guiding.
All right.
Or their own consciousness were then, which is for instrumental at that time.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Also, place. Place is important where
place,
you are, yes, because it's all one spirit. There is a profound book written, Ethnogenesis and Biosphere of Earth, by Humilov. And he was a scholar academician in Russia who believes that the place and people who live in that place, they have something in common. They share the same spirit, same character, the landscape, the culture, the color, all those influences, language. Language itself reflects something of the landscape. I'm nearly finished with my time today. I thought I would be faster, really, but it seems it takes a little longer. But maybe I will finish one thought about Socrates finally. That was which is important, I think, for this gathering. So, what was interesting for me to find that logocentrism of Derrida being somewhere generated. There had to be some origin, and I found it in Socratic thinking, which was taken by Plato later and Aristotle, and taken differently than Socrates was talking. He was still a shift from one view to another. He was still looking back and speaking another. He was like a missionary, visionary. But then what happened, his vision was taken as a ground, and on that ground was another system of knowledge built. So what happened, Plato later would completely insist on this preference of the rational approach, introducing the written language as a norm against the spoken word of the bards of Homerian type. In his ideal republic, he even banishes all the poets out of the city. They had not to confuse the rational way of inquiry. We have to be systematized. That's what happened in China, when Chinese emperors were destroying all the languages and introducing only one way of speaking, one language, one way of writing, because there were too many languages. People were not understanding each other. Now we are... Aristotle is a big topic. Maybe we stop here, yes, before Aristotle. So what I wanted to slowly build is to come to that particular answer where logocentrism appeared. And I can clearly see how it appeared. I want to share this with you. If we can see together that particular shift, that which is based on mysterious origin of language.
It's important, I think, to say what logocentrism means also.
Yes.
one of the things that it means is that the world of ideas is more real than the world of process. That there's a preference in thinking. Superiority is given to the rational over the emotional, to the spiritual over the material. There's a dichotomy is created between those things of the mind and of the good, and those things of the body and of the bad. This is a fundamental schism that takes place between rationalizing and being continuous with the world of experience, direct experience.
It's also a moment where, because of this mind-body split, the body becomes denoted to the place of material, the mother becomes materiality only, and you end up with this patriarchal world which is basically delivering because of this split.
The split is very valid. And the split is very creative in a way, but if it would be not taken by logocentric thinking, it would be very valuable to have, because we have the same in Indic tradition, but it is not overtaken by domination of one over the other. There was never a mixture of these two, of signified and signifier, as we saw it. They were coexisting together very well and were both necessary for the manifestation of the spirit. But this idea that they can coexist in a harmonious oneness was impossible after Plato and Aristotle, and we will see why. And that was what logocentrism represents, that there was a preference for the thinking rather than for being. That's why being was in some way constructed all the time. And it wasn't bad for the development of Western civilization. It makes sense. But it comes to the end, where we are no more satisfied with this way of thinking, because it leads us to the disaster, basically.
In Heidegger's understanding, it leads us to the technological point of view, right, exclusive of any other value.
Yeah. So we end today on this, and then we continue next time. Thank you.